Thank you, Taureen. Good morning, everyone. I want to thank you for the invitation and the opportunity to be here with you this morning. Thank you to my friend and colleague, Dr. Ray, who we are working on a document together around white privilege, and I found his scholarship and his leadership to be invaluable to me at this time. And I have to confess that my nervousness went up about 300% when I saw Dr. Iva Carruthers, who I consider to be Mama Iva Carruthers, one who is responsible for first opening my eyes, to be honest with you, to what's happening in Palestine and leading with great skill us at the Proctor Conference in this very important work, as well as liberation work in all areas. So be kind to me, Mama Iva. Also glad to see Sandy here, who I've just recently met when I was at Southern Illinois, who I know is very active and involved in this work. And upon knowing that I was going to the Middle East, had a long conversation with me, which I took to heart, and it helped me look for some things that I might not have looked for had it not been for that conversation. So I'm grateful for that. I also want to disclose to you that this is the first time that I've had this conversation about Ferguson since returning from my first visit to Palestine in March. And so I ask your permission to think out loud with you today as I begin to formulate my thoughts around what I have seen, believing that once you see, you cannot unsee. So I present to you today my reflections on the connections between Ferguson and Palestine. I think that is what I've been tasked to do. And I present them as a theological dilemma. There's a West African proverb that states, until the lion tells the story, the hunter will always be the hero. It is interesting how the hunter tells the story. It is always different than the lion. On August 9th, 2014, Michael Brown Jr., an unarmed 18-year-old black male child, was killed by then-officer Darren Wilson. This was neither the first nor the last time an unarmed black male child has met his demise in this manner in Ferguson, and certainly it was not the first such killing of its sorts in St. Louis, of which Ferguson is just one of 91 municipalities that comprise our region. As a matter of fact, prior to August 9th, there had already been 130 killings of black youth in 2014 alone. Yet this lone encounter between Michael Brown Jr. and Darren Wilson, which lasted only 2 minutes, from the moment the officer stopped and told Michael Brown and his friend to get out of the street, to the moment the officer shot him 7 times from a distance of 148 feet in the middle of that same street, 2 minutes. If the officer's intent was to secure the safety of Michael and his friend as pedestrians, or to prevent the obstruction of traffic, I believe we can all agree that this was an epic fail on all fronts. But what the events of that day did do was ignite a flame of rage and resistance that was further stoked by the fact that Michael's bullet-riddled body was left exposed and laying in that same street for over 4.5 hours without any attempt at medical intervention and absent any compassion for his mother and father, who were standing for a large portion of that time on the other side of some yellow tape. Both Ferguson and St. Louis were changed that day, no matter how you tell the story. In the following days, the relatively small area of the municipality that held the unrest became larger than life as our entire region would become redefined as Ferguson. St. Louis went from being the gateway to the Midwest to being known for two things, the Arch and Ferguson. And simultaneously, the world became smaller as young people in Palestine began tweeting young people in Ferguson with instructions on how to make homemade gas masks and avoid the most damaging effects of airborne chemicals that were deployed against protesters whose most powerful weapons were their bodies. And yes, there were some who threw water bottles. And yes, there were some who lit matches, just as Palestinians sometimes throw stones. Because when your giant seems unbeatable, you resist with whatever is near. These tweets became a lifeline, and Ferguson protesters grabbed them. Law enforcement's response to a sea of black bodies armed with their voices, a militarized police force, armored trucks, and sniper posts, not in a war zone, but in a residential area that may have seemed large to you on TV. TV has a way of doing that, but we're really talking about 4 or 5 blocks. Ironically, it is not only Ferguson protesters who have a connection with Palestinians that is important, but law enforcement's increasing connection with the Israeli military. After 9/11, the U.S. began sending police chiefs to Israel to train in counterterrorism techniques. And as these trips to Israel became more commonplace, the militarization of U.S. law enforcement, also driven by the creation of Homeland Security initiatives and billions of dollars of surplus military-grade equipment donated to local police departments, formed a bond. Counterterrorism. Certainly necessary for some after 9/11, but in our neighborhoods, when you arm local police departments with military gear and military vehicles for counter-terrorist work, who becomes the terrorist? Some of this weaponry we now know found its way to Ferguson. And the terrorist? Young black bodies who refused to be denied their right to assemble, their right to nonviolent protest, and their right to be treated as citizens of these United States. I carried my memories of the Ferguson uprising with me on my first trip to Palestine. And there I was reminded of the hunter and the lion. I came to understand that uprising is the language of the hunter. Occupation is the language of the lion. The same situation, it simply depends on who's telling the story. In the West Bank, I experienced a heightened level of checkpoints, not unlike the checkpoints I experienced on the streets of my own city when there was need to control both who resisted and the narrative of their actions. In Ferguson, I was required to show my license and state my reason for entering an area that was only 3 miles from where I minister daily. I needed a license to enter my streets. Whose streets? our streets that were now occupied by increased law enforcement presence that's never there when we're looking for jobs. Never there when businesses are closing. Never there when young people are being sent to schools that are unaccredited. Never there when there is communal violence. But all of a sudden, I need permission to be on my streets. In Palestine, I was required to show my passport. And the state and to state the intention of my visit. I was with a delegation of leaders from the Disciples of Christ, the United Church of Christ, the Congregational Church of South Africa, and the United Church of Canada. The majority of the delegation did not look like me. The two South African representatives were stopped at every checkpoint. And I will never forget what it felt like to finally arrive at the airport with this large delegation of 21, wearing the throw that I am wearing today, the last to get off of the plane, and watch security see me and make a pathway through everyone else who was with me and ask me, where did you come from? In Ferguson, the media was not interested in covering the cinder blocks that were placed at one end of Canfield Apartments where Michael Brown was killed, effectively containing residents in a specific area with only one way in and one way out. In America, there's not much talk of the wall being built to hold Palestinians in a similar toxic embrace. While there, I visited Ramallah. And I sat in the home of a mother whose 15-year-old son, Waji, was killed by an Israeli sniper 5 months earlier. Waji had asked his mother after school could he return to the playground because the playground was a safe place for children, so we're told. He wanted to go back to school and play soccer now that he had finished his homework for the day. And so his mother, who was pregnant at the time and wanted some rest, allowed him to go back to the school. And within 5 minutes, friends came running to the door. Waji had been shot, they said. Because she was pregnant, they didn't want to tell her that her son was dead. They said he was shot in the leg. And she went running to the school playground because that's what mothers do, only to find out when she arrived that Waji had been shot in the back and killed by a sniper who was some distance away protecting a settlement that was close to the school. She was never given an explanation for her son's murder, only that he was believed to be a threat. And as I listened to her story with tears in my eyes to match the tears in hers, I was reminded of the Ferguson that is Cleveland, Ohio, where I now work, where 12-year-old Tamir Rice was gunned down within 2 seconds of encountering a police officer in the playground while he was swinging and holding a toy gun. The person who called in the suspicious boy in Cleveland stated on the recorded call that they did not think the gun was real And even though Ohio is an open carry state, the reality, my friends, is that dark skin in poor neighborhoods transforms play into an act of resistance. There are many similarities of what it means to be a lion in occupied territory. And on my final day there, I was most reminded of the differences in those stories when I had the privilege of visiting the U.S. consulate. The only place that I have no pictures of because they won't let you take them. We met with the assistant deputy director. We happened to be in Palestine at the same time that Vice President Biden was making a visit. And unfortunately, during this time, an American student was killed. She indeed was killed by a Palestinian. And it was a random stabbing, we're told. And the assistant deputy director began her comments to us, expressing the level of violence that they endure every day, the number of stabbings and the attacks against Israeli citizens, she said. The violence that was out of control, and so out of control that they were not even able to prevent it from happening during this visit, and the tragic loss of life of this American child. And I grieved for that child as well. I listened because I have learned from being a black body in America that language has power. And as dangerous as the occupation of a people is the occupation of a narrative. So I waited for some balance in her statements. I waited for her to address the tensions on both sides and to, quite frankly, acknowledge the complicitness of this country that I love so much in what we were seeing, but it didn't come. All of the violence that she kept repeating over and over again, the violent nature of these attacks, the violence of the people, were all descriptors used for Palestinians. So when I had listened as much as I could, I raised my hand and told her how proud I was to be an American and how grateful I was and sensitive to the difficult situation she finds herself in, but that I have learned that my liberation is not only in my acts, but it is in my language. And for this reason, I had to challenge her use of the word violence. My understanding of violence includes that, but it does not exclude some other things. So I explained to her that I had spent the last 10 days looking at a people who were severely oppressed. And I define violence as the taking of land that does not belong to you. I define violence as the destruction of neighborhoods so that other people can prosper on the backs of people who were there before. I define violence as settlements that are strategically placed so that Palestinians can no longer even have significant hope of becoming a state. I define violence as having to validate yourself, to be in land that was once declared as belonging to you, and now even the name of it has been taken from you. That to me is also violence. And though I don't condone the killing of anyone, it seemed quite unfair to measure the wielding of a knife against the weapons of destruction that I had been inundated with for 10 days. So, can we talk about this word violence? I said. Her assistant said to me that no one had ever talked to them that way. And then asked for my name. I guess I won't be going back. But something else happened in that conversation, because somehow it gave her permission to think about things a little bit differently. Perhaps it's because I stated up front and she knew that I was first and foremost a pastor, a person of faith. And I spoke to her from that perspective because, my friends, I am convinced that what is happening in Ferguson and what is happening in Baltimore and what is happening in Chicago and what is happening all over this United States, and indeed what is happening in Palestine, between Palestine and Israel, is not at its core a political situation or a social situation. At its very core, it is a theological situation. You see, I don't believe that people are born into politics, but many of us are born into faith. And whether we embrace it or whether we reject it, it is something that we grow up with as being a part of the water that we swim in. And as Christians, my friends, we have treated our sacred texts as if it is God's story of a holy people instead of a people's story of a holy God. We have constructed a God of favoritism instead of a God of favor. What does one do with a God who would choose a piece of God's creation over everybody else? How do we make that work as people of faith? How do we understand all of creation in the context of a chosen people? Now, I know I might get some hate mail for that, but it is a reality that we must grapple with. Because what is happening in Palestinian land is the result of masses of people having a theology in which you cannot speak against those who are chosen. And just as the Jews are chosen in that part of the world, white supremacy is chosen here. We both have declared chosen people. And it makes all other people dispensable. I was further reminded of this as I prepare to return to Palestine in July, this time with a rabbi who has become a very good friend of mine and a Palestinian. We're taking 20 young people to Israel for 10 days, all expenses paid, to have this conversation while we see what cannot be unseen. It was extremely important that I took this first trip with the delegation I took this trip with, because what we see also depends upon our context. I'm wrestling with this trip because I assumed that the Palestinian that would be a part of the trio leading the delegation was from Palestine. But I met her last week, and she is a Palestinian who is an Israeli citizen. How is that important, and what does it matter? In all honesty, I have to say, when we met, it was 11 o'clock at night. I came straight from the airport from New York. I was tired, and she had been speaking all day, so both of us had already put our politeness to bed. In our encounter with one another, I began to share with her what I had seen and some of the things that I hoped we would dialogue about while we were there with the young people. And she said to me, the people you were with, they showed you what they wanted you to see. Did they show you the Palestinians who live well in Ramallah? Did you only see the mother who was suffering and the poor people in the camp? Did they take you up into the hills and show you the mansions of Palestinians who aren't living in camps, Palestinians who have money? Did they show you the women who are doing well and hanging out outside, drinking tea and smoking? Did they show you the good side, or did you only see the bad side? And my response was, they didn't show me what you're talking about, but I'm not surprised it exists. I don't need to see it because I know rich black people too. But it does not erase the story of Ferguson. You see, this is what the hunter's narrative teaches us. That the lion who escapes is justification for saying the ones who are killed deserved it. It, my friend, has its origin in what we believe about a God who is so schizophrenic that God would choose to hate parts of God's breath and elevate others. I suggest to you that what we see in Ferguson and what we see in Palestine will not change based on what's happening at the Capitol, will not change based on what's happening in Israeli government, but must change based on the deconstruction of a biblical narrative that most of us have been complicit in. It must change in the courage to revisit the story so that all people are the chosen people of God. And when that happens, then things like BDS are no longer anti-Semitic. Things like talking about Israeli occupation and holding people accountable for agreements made in the UN is no longer anti-Semitic. And black bodies will no longer be seen as the terrorists of this United States. Thank you.
When you think about so many of the things that you mentioned in your presentation, and you think about the control of movement, the Palestinians have no rights that the state of Israel is bound to respect, and a U.S. empire that did it to do the very same regarding its black populations. And when you think about the ways in which all of these things are mediated, right, in our national consciousness. So where is it that you find the presence of this unmoved mover by him? Where is it that you see that?
Thank you, Tareen. When I was in seminary, I had the privilege of going to Ghana with my seminary class, and we stayed a month, and that trip has framed my life. That was in 2009. It reframed my life and how I experience things. When I originally signed up for that trip, I come from a pretty strict evangelical background as a person. And I thought this was my opportunity to do mission work. Yeah, it was that kind of moment. And my instructor began this month-long process of deconstructing that for me and assuring me that God had already found God's way to Ghana and that I wasn't needed in that regard, but that this trip was not so much for me to witness to, but to bear witness of. And so the question became, where do you see God in this? Where do you see God in this? And so I went to Ghana looking for God and came to learn that when you look for God, you find God doing what God does in ways that complete that context. And so how that relates to Ferguson is that when Ferguson happened, I went to Ferguson looking for God. I didn't go looking for the church because I knew we wouldn't be there, but I was looking for God. And where I find God in moments like this, and the same was true in Palestine for me, is I find God in the resistance. I found God in Ferguson many times, but I'll tell you two quick times. In the height of the resistance, how many of you saw images of Ferguson on TV when it looked like a war zone? In the height of that, when protesters were in a literal standoff with police officers, and police officers were in riot gear standing in front of the police station, and protesters were standing on the other side of the street in parking lots, that had businesses that really weren't getting much business during this time. In the height of that, many of the young people were so fueled by what was going on that they weren't even going home, that this was a 24/7 thing. There were police out there 24/7. There were protesters out there 24/7. And about the third day, it began to occur to some of us that perhaps some of them weren't going home because they didn't have homes. That's always a situation. And then others who were choosing just to be out there were not even taking the time to eat because most of the businesses were closed and there wasn't a lot of food coming in. And there was a woman and her husband who had become a part of the movement early on. We called her Mama Cat. Her name is Catherine. I ask that you include her in your prayers. She's in the hospital right now. But Mama Cat was retired military. And at the time that Michael Brown was killed, Mama Cat was in culinary school. She had decided she wanted her second career to be a chef. Sandy probably knows her well. And her husband was retired military at all. And one evening, in the midst of all of the unrest, Mama Cat and her husband drove into the street, West Florissant, which is where we were, South Florissant, and onto the parking lot where all the protesters gather. And without saying a word, they were in a truck. Without saying a word, let me say this as well. I don't know them to be, I know them to be people of faith. I don't know them to be people of the church. We've just never had that conversation. And so I make no assertions about that piece. But they drove up in this truck. They both got out and began to unload church tables. Now, I don't know where they got the church tables from, but a lot of people have church tables and church chairs that mysteriously appear at their family reunions. So they pulled out these church tables. Can I stand? I'm kind of tired of sitting down. They pulled out these church tables and silently began to put linen tablecloths on these tables. And then they started unloading chafing dishes. And they brought these chafing dishes with those little portable burner things out onto this parking lot, and everybody's starting to say, what are they doing? And then pots started coming out because Mama Cat had been up all night cooking, and she filled these pots with food, and then she put disposable plates and disposable silverware at the end of the table, and she said, anybody who is hungry, y'all come eat. She said it loudly for all these people who didn't know each other. She said it loudly enough even for the policemen who were on the other side. If you are hungry, you are welcome at this table. And because I look for God, what I saw was communion. I saw a communion that was more holy than anything I have ever held inside the four walls of my beautiful sanctuary. I saw a communion that was more scripturally compatible with what I read about the Last Supper than I had ever seen before. She didn't ask any questions about who was faithful and who wasn't, and who deserved to be there and who wasn't. If you were hungry, just eat. I saw God there. I saw God in the relationship between a rapper by the name of Tef Poe and a militant sister by the name of Tara, who didn't know each other before this happened, who met on the streets of Ferguson, a young boy who at the time was 15 years old. We call him Loki. He had been on the streets since he was 10. His mother had put him out of the house, and no governmental agency had picked up on him missing. He hadn't been in school. He had been living from sofa to sofa and sometimes outside. And in the midst of all of this chaos, he found family. And he declared that Tara was now his mother, that Tef was now his father. And he brought them together and said, "Now you guys got to figure out how to take care of me." And so two people who came out to protest, who really didn't have that kind of relationship with one another, assumed responsibility for this 15-year-old. Allowing him to sleep between the houses, beginning to use their own finances to buy him clothes and to give him an allowance, called me to say, "If he's gonna be our son, he's gotta go to school. Can you help us get him in the GED program at your church?" He was too young and yet too old to go back into high school. And so they began working with him to prepare him so that when he turned 17, that he would be ready for a GED, and gave him his first birthday party at 16. This, my friend, is what it means to take care of one another. And I saw God in that real life Samaritan story. God is present in the margins of society. God is always present with those who are oppressed. I see God in resistance.
Talk some more about the two different visions. You know, God's in the margins, but there's maybe a New Testament of the deep God and the passionate God.
I push back a little bit, and I'm glad you said that, because I wouldn't want you to leave here thinking that that's what I meant. I am suggesting that there are not two gods, that there is one God, but there are two sides of humanity. I'm suggesting that the battle is within us, and that it's not so clean cut as to say that one is oppressed and one is the oppressor, but that both sides live within all of us. And the war is, who will we let reign? I'm not suggesting that God is in any way divided among God's self. God is a God of all people. But in our humanity, we struggle. And where we come down depends on whether we're the hunter or the lion. And in our life, there are moments and places where we are the hunter, and there are moments and places where we are the lion. And when we find ourselves in the position of the hunter, as people of faith, we have a greater responsibility to acknowledge that and to do what we can to make sure that we don't co-opt the story of the lion. In my own struggles, I definitely identify as being oppressed because of the color of my skin. But I'm also straight. And in that area, I have to deal with my ability and my comfortability in dismissing those who are same gender loving. In areas of faith, I am Christian. And at least for right now, I enjoy many, many privileges because I am Christian. And so it is incumbent upon me to bear some of that burden of the responsibility of not speaking for others who are of different faiths, but making sure that I make space for those who are of different faiths. God has God's act together. It's us that need work.
I was pleased that you are calling for a deconstruction of the biblical narrative that has God elevating some and hating others. You to explain a little bit about how you would proceed with that deconstruction. Is it a case of establishing origin mythologies and showing that a Moses and an Exodus and Israelites slaughtering Canaanites and the David and the Solomon, that all of that is an origin mythology that is favoring violence of some over others?
Phew, that's why I brought it to you guys.
Yeah.
You're the heavy thinkers. I'll tell you how. I think that depends a lot on context. You have to start with people where they are. In the local church setting, I'm not in academia, so in academia I think very much that your approach is valid and necessary in the walls of academia, which will funnel out into the streets. But at my church, where I pastor 140 people, predominantly black, who grew up believing Sunday school and believing the stories of their parents, oftentimes which were stories that they told that were adaptations of scripture, I am intentional about the words I use. And so even when I talk about our holy book, I describe it as the story of a people about their relationship with God. In the black context, I often talk about the many ways that we found a way to deconstruct scriptures that would have us still be slaves, deconstruct scriptures that would make us subservient, even when it was taught to us this way, because we ultimately understand God to be a God of liberation. And then I just pose the questions. What kind of God would God be if we began with a narrative that says the very breath of God created all beings, and then somewhere along the way, other beings just don't matter as much? I don't try to make excuses for passages of scripture that are problematic. I wrestle with them openly, and I don't always have the answer. What do you do with a Joshua that is commanded in scripture to go into a land that is occupied and to kill everybody in it and take it over? Is this consistent with the God that we know? And so I'm suggesting that that deconstruction of looking at this book as something to not be touched, something to not be challenged, and removing from our intellectual process the notion that it is a story of a people, not the entire story, gives us room to have those conversations. I tease people and say, the only place in Scripture where John is the disciple whom Jesus loved is when John is talking. Nobody else calls John that. It's the same with this narrative. I told you I'm evangelical Pentecostal to my roots. I'm being changed over, but I'm still there. It is a holy book for me. But I cannot ignore that humans have had a hand in it. And if I'm going to tell a story, I'm going to tell it to my advantage. So I'm prayerful that we'll begin to have more. I know it happens in seminaries. It happened in mine. I wasn't always listening. But more conversations that push us, those of us who are going to go out and pastor people, to be accountable and responsible for how we use the sacred texts.
Reverend Blackmore.
Thank you.
Yeah.